Hello, I'm Adrian Dobb, and this is In Bed with the Right. So this week's episode is a little bit different. Moira is traveling, and I'm traveling, and part of my travel, I mean, I'm visiting family, but I'm also in Germany researching Project 1933, the final episode of which was going to be, and still is going to be, the final episode we do in 2025. Basically, it's turned out to not be a great idea to record what will likely be a two-hour episode, conclusion to a pretty massive, what is it, 10-part series, 11-part series, I don't even know, on hotel Wi-Fi with a six-hour time difference. Not recommended. Anyway, we weren't able to get this all squared away this week, so we thought, well, why don't we just pull something from the vaults? The vaults in this case being our Patreon. We thought, given that it's the holidays, given that many of you are probably traveling, given that some of you are probably dealing with families, et cetera, why not make it a real doozy? So we decided on our two-part series on none other than noted gender conservative Andrew Sullivan. It's an episode that we did back in the summer, and we're going to release one episode today and one on Friday. And yeah, it's an episode we remain very proud of. I think we really got into what makes this man so maddening, so interesting, and we were able to, I think, accord him a great deal of humanity and a great deal of understanding while also really calling him out on all his, spoiler alert, copious bullshit. Speaking of which, if this is the kind of content you like, if you think like, wow, 3 hours of podcasting on Andrew Sullivan sounds awesome to me, or if you just like our style sort of more off the cuff on the Patreon and you're not yet a supporter, this might also be a good moment to subscribe at patreon.com/embedwiththeright. The Patreon and the community that goes with it, including on Patreon itself and on Discord, is absolutely wonderful. So if you're into that sort of thing, why not, you know, like, subscribe, review us on iTunes, and then go to patreon.com. All right, well, I'll leave it at that. Take care of yourselves, have a wonderful holiday, and can't wait to talk to you next week and the new year after that. Hello, I'm Adrian Dobb.
And I'm Moira Donegan.
Whether we like it or not, we're in bed with the right.
So Adrian, today we are tackling one of the most significant forces in gender conservatism in my lifetime, I think, one of our white whales on this podcast, one of our bugaboos, and somebody we think is litigious and annoying enough that we decided to put this one behind the paywall on the Patreon. So it's only for our true heads.
That's right.
Today we are talking about a gentleman named Andrew Sullivan.
We're doing it. It's hot white whale summer. We're doing Schlafly. We're doing Enlightenment. We're doing Tar. And we're doing Andrew Sullivan. Should we talk about our relationship to this man to start with, or do we want to weave that into the story?
Let's get our caveats and disclosures out of the way.
Yeah.
To begin with, because Andrew Sullivan is a guy who has come after me personally.
Yeah.
He is a British-born conservative pundit. He has worked at basically every major publication writing about politics. So he was most famously in the early 90s, the editor-in-chief of the New Republic. He also worked for the New York Times Magazine. He worked for the Daily Beast. He worked for Time, I think. And he is a Gen X, maybe late boomer paragon of the political blogging generation. Yeah. And he is somebody who has made his career as a conservative. We only have a couple of these people, like Katie Royfe does the same thing. Like, they say over and over again the same point that they've been making since the 90s, which is like the left has gone too far, right? Yeah. That is basically the substance of everything he has ever written. And he is like a malevolent Forrest Gump, right? We have a couple of these people where his is a story that touches on a lot of recurring themes in American politics, but more or less every big controversy that has arisen through media, through American conservatism. He has been there over the past 30 years, and he has been like a figure shaping conservative thought about it, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes in a kind of you know, I think the nice word would be iconoclastic. The not nice word would be incoherent manner, right? Yeah. He is like not a guy with a very legible set of principles and political commitments, but he does have this notion that there's one set of actors in American political life, and it is left. And then there is a passive right wing that doesn't really seem to be like ascribed much agency, right? And passivity is the one thing he seems to very consistently believe in, right? He thinks the people acting to change the world, at least progressives, are always doing something wrong by doing so.
So maybe we should justify what we're talking about this guy. So I think there are four reasons why I was interested and why, honestly, it's taken us this long and 14 pages of very small notes to get to the bottom of this. This might be a long one, folks. Strap in. To talk about Andrew Sullivan is to talk about an era, which is a little strange given that he's still quite productive, quite influential. But in rereading his oeuvre, I'm just like struck by how 90s this guy is, right?
Yeah.
So many walks down memory lane, like weird.coms, blogs, left-wing McCarthyism, the bell curve. I reread my colleague Paul Robinson's book Queer Wars, which is in part a attack on Andrew Sullivan from like 2003 or 2004. So the first book to really think about what is gay conservatism. And there's a little bit in one of the chapters on Sullivan where he has to define what a blog is.
Oh my
and
God.
You're like, yeah, man,
once
this
upon
is...
Once upon a time. Yeah. Yeah. So Sullivan is, you know, we mentioned that he's been sort of everywhere. He is this blogger. He has been a opinion columnist and political commentator. We mentioned the bell curve, his sort of famous endorsement of a early 90s book that purported to show a link between race and intelligence, like heritable intelligence. He was a big proponent of the Iraq War. He was a very early proponent from the right of gay marriage, and Andrew Sullivan is a gay man. He published his first argument for gay marriage, I believe, in the New Republic in like 1989.
That's right.
And then it became the subject of a book he published in the early 90s called Virtually Normal, which I think we're going to get into a lot. And now he has since taken on the position that gay rights is over. We won. We did it, and that anything that happens in this space now is substantively not just counterproductive, but actively evil, right?
Yeah. So that's, I think, the second reason to look at really the extent of his output, because he contains these contradictions, as you say, that really build a bridge between the sort of anti-PC discourse of the 90s and today's anti-wokesters, I feel like, mm-hmm. right? He thrives on contrarianism and on conflict. But at the same time, as you say, there's something amazing about a mind that is able to find something of interest in the bell curve for 30 years. Like, it's like, move on, man. It just feels very stuck in some way. He doesn't apply his own principles consistently, right? He clearly sees himself as this bold, heterodox truth teller, right? Same as what he thinks with about Murray. But as you say, in his post-9/11 writings, he seems absolutely allergic to people being heterodox truth tellers and seems very ready to like basically sick the feds on them. He is on the one hand a very public man, but also like has, to my mind, an antiquated public-private distinction that seems very, very central to his own self-perception.
Yes, and to his politics. This is something I want to talk about, is like the maleness of his particular brand of gay conservatism and the sort of myopic obliviousness to like the realities of women's lives that have allowed Andrew Sullivan to have the worldview that he has.
Yeah, and I think that's probably a third reason to look at him, because the Supreme Court, again, seems to be using private rights of citizens to curtail the public rights of citizens who happen to be LGBT right now. That's clearly their strategy. This is what this last term of the Supreme Court has wrought. And it's been going on for a while now. But it's very clear that they're saying private citizens' right to discriminate against gay people in public outweighs their right not to get discriminated against. It's a position that really carried the day, but that now is really coming back to bite the movement in the ass. Andrew Sullivan seems to take zero responsibility for that, even though he had a big hand in shaping this.
Another thing that's really interesting about Andrew Sullivan is that he is like the mold in which a lot of our subsequent reactionary centrists were cast, right? He's the prototype of this kind of pundit that's now everywhere, right? There's a sense of being like victimized and aggrieved in his work. There's a lot of like moralism, like normative moralism that like strives to like position itself as principle in his work. And these are things that like you really see being reproduced in like your John McWhorters, your Thomas Chatterton Williams, your like Jonathan Chaitz, right? There's like a posture that has now become like endemic to this certain kind of thought that I really do see him as being like patient zero for.
I mean, people have had his number on this for a while. And researching this, I read a really good piece by Richard Goldstein in the Village Voice from 2001. And he points out, quote, "The fact is that launching an attack on gay, quote, orthodoxies is the surest route to celebrity for a homosexual thinker. Anyone who breaks with the movement is called courageous. Anyone who mocks queer mores is seen as a true individual. In reality, writers like Paglia and Sullivan are reassuring rogues, affirming the biases that straights dare not admit they hold." I think that's very, very, very good. And it's shocking how often people have called this guy on his shit, and he just kind of keeps plugging away at it. You don't want to hand it to a man, but, you know, he reads all these. We know that. And he's like, yeah, that's what I'm doing. I'm going to keep going.
He's a testament to the kind of career you can have if you're, like, completely impervious to shame, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So let's get into the biography. What is the world that created this man, Andrew Sullivan?
The way I thought we'd structure this, or the way we agreed to structure this, would be that we're going to mostly focus on 10 essays, books, articles of his. So yes, 10. We'll see how much we get through.
You come to In Bid With the Right for the real deep dives, right? Yeah. This is not a place for the casual listener. This is a place for the true freaks. And we're on the Patreon, so we can really let it fly.
You're all coming with us. Yeah. But we'll try to fill in what happened to him in between these texts. Sullivan was born in Surrey, England in 1963. I couldn't quite figure out what his family background is, but it does seem to be more working class. Like, I think his parents were not poor, but they were also not pedigreed. I think that's important, given what his own career looks like with Oxford and then Harvard.
Yeah, he's a guy who's got a lot of investment in, like, English class markers, but was not necessarily born into them.
His mother, he said, has been in and out of mental hospitals. She appears to have been quite mentally ill, which I think does matter, because Sullivan is at his most movingly conservative, I would say, as someone who thinks through the things that are just given in our lives.
What you're getting at is that he does very consistently have a sense of fatedness, or a resistance to a social or historical explanation for some sort of factors that he sees as like pre-social and fundamental to the human psyche and identity.
I believe he has once said that one of the scenes that ushered him into conservatism was an effort by the Labour government to integrate basically different streams in British schools. Keep that in mind.
He was in a admissions selective school where he had been identified as promising or as different in some sort of superior way. And the school he was at, I believe it was like a secondary school or like a grammar school or something. The school he was at was integrated with another school, or it was the officials tried to integrate it with another school that was not admissions selective. And he found this very offensive.
Yeah. So that's important. We'll get back to that in a second. He then went to Oxford, studied at Magdalen College.
Magdalen.
It's Magdalen.
It's Magdalen? They call it Magdalen? Oh my God. This is one of those things as in like overdone, dramatic, sad.
Look,
it is a bit Magdalen at Oxford, I have to say.
They're not subtle people. yes, but yeah, it goes to Magdalen. I mean, if I'm wrong about this, I'm going to be very embarrassed, but I'm pretty sure it's pronounced Magdalen.
What if they were just fucking with you?
I know.
The Brits. I don't know. That doesn't strike me as their kind of humor.
No. In Austria, that's what would happen. They're like, that's not pronounced at all. You're like, you bastards. Anyway, he studies there, I think, 81 to 84 about. And I think that's important for two reasons, right? That's the height of Thatcherism. And it's the moment AIDS appears in the public record. This is when a young man of Sullivan's age would have found out about this, right?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, college is when a lot of people start having the sex that defines their adult lives, right? So he's becoming a sexually active adult at the same time that this sort of like existential threat to people whose sexuality is like his is emerging.
Yeah. At one of the gayer places on earth.
And I think it might be interesting to talk briefly, and we might get into this later, about the role of AIDS in shaping his conservatism.
Yes.
Because it seems like it looms large for gay conservatives of that generation.
That's right. We'll talk about that. And the other thing that I think I couldn't find confirmation on, but it does strike me that there is this... So he goes to Oxford, and he's running in like circles that would define post-Thatcherite conservatism in the UK, right? He was on a trajectory to be part, not really to be a writer about the conservative movement, but to be a big political part of it. That doesn't end up happening. And I do wonder to what extent his homosexuality is basically the stumbling block, right? In Virtually Normal, he speaks of, quote, those who grow up and find themselves different, and that's his problem. He could be a Thatcherite foot soldier, except he finds himself different. I do wonder whether his decision to go to the US afterwards isn't sort of about that.
So after college, instead of, you know, going to work for a Tory MP, or whatever the trajectory of such a young man might be, he instead goes to Harvard and he gets his PhD in government there.
Exactly. He goes to Harvard Kennedy School of Governance and pursues
School of Government.
Ah, shit.
No, it's all right. We're getting the names of the fancy schools wrong. And I think it speaks to our populist authenticity.
Yeah.
Look at us, salt to the earth. Stanford employed San Franciscans.
I've still not been. But yeah, so his dissertation advisor is none other than Harvey Mansfield, conservative author of a book on masculinity that he had not written then, but very smart guy. And he writes a dissertation entitled Intimations Pursued, The Voice of Practice in the Conversation of Michael Oakeshott. So this is on the then fairly unknown British philosopher Michael Oakeshott.
So for our listeners who aren't familiar, can you just give us a brief gloss on Michael Oakeshott, this very influential thinker in the life of Andrew Sullivan?
Yeah, so I'll try. I've read very little Oakeshott in my day. I read parts of Andrew Sullivan's dissertation about him.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's very committed.
It came out like a couple of years ago in this like series on sort of Oakeshott studies. And it's basically, I think, a conservatism, is my read, that's not based on natural law or revelation, right? Oakeshott appears to have been a religious thinker, but it's not a religiously derived conservatism. And I think it's neo-Burkean, but with a more pronounced kind of quietism, right? As Sullivan says in his book on conservatism, that, quote, there is no way, Oakeshott argues, to generate a personal moral life from a book, a text, a theory. We live the way we have grown accustomed to live. Our morality is like a language we have learned and deploy in every new instant. That's to say, for him, it's conservatism about sensibility, and I think that's true for Sullivan too at some points, and it is about a way of being in the world. It's not necessarily about precepts being applied. That's the province of the left. That's like, oh, it's all class struggle, and then arranges their life to into a pretzel in order to fit that, basically.
There's I guess you could generously call it flexibility in Oakeshott's thought that presupposes that the attempt to shape the world is itself what leads to like injustice and struggle, which I think is very, that is something that is quite consistent in Andrew Sullivan's thought, even when the actual ideologies are not, right? It's interesting that you say that this is like a secular conservatism, because I think something that we should probably get into about Andrew Sullivan, he is a Catholic. He is from a family of Irish extraction, and he has retained his Catholicism, but he kind of wears it like a loose garment, right? He sort of reserves the right to depart from the Catholic teaching on things such as homosexuality, right?
Not abortion, not IVF,
but he's got this kind of like capacity for the self-interested muting of like the conclusion that his professed principles would always lead him to, right? Andrew Sullivan is the rare pundit who professes to be both a faithful Catholic and somebody who departs from Catholicism quite often.
The influence of Oakeshott is really interesting in the same way that the Catholicism is really interesting the way you're describing it, because it's interesting how much he takes himself to be following it while not following it.
Yeah.
Right? Because Sullivan is two things at once, right? He's a prophet of demobilization. And that's the Oakeshottian argument, I think. It's all about stuff that gay people shouldn't be fighting for, how they shouldn't fight, right? Like, this is a bad way of arguing or fighting. We should stop fighting like this. We should stop yelling about this. He just seems generally all about this remove, about let's not get over-invested in these struggles. Let's be sort of aloof. His conservatism book is all about this kind of temperament that sort of stands back and takes stock. Now, the first person to be surprised by that stance would be Andrew Sullivan, because unlike Pamela Paul, who I think comes by a very similar demobilizing ethic, the old-fashioned way, she appears to just want to read some books in her nook and, like, you kids to stay out of her goddamn yard.
She also wants to be congratulated for it, which is another...
Yeah, yeah, okay, that is annoying.
That's something they do have in common, yeah.
Yeah, but he's also a huge controversialist, never happier than when he's picking a fight with others, and at the same time, he's never happy with the fights once he's picked them. But anyway, it's just very funny that this guy who keeps stirring up shit is also, yeah, but I'm at this conservative remove. There's a very nice review in the New York Review of Books of Sullivan's book, The Conservative Soul, which was his defection from the Bush presidency, 2006, where Oakeshott stood self-consciously aloof from practical politics. Sullivan splashes excitedly about in them like a dog in a mud puddle, snarling ferociously at any other dog who challenges his position du jour. He's less a skeptic than a mercurial and somewhat flirtatious born believer. And I think that's so right. I think he really has his number. There is this tendency in Sullivan to believe himself to be aloof and Olympian while just cottoning on to different causes over time, which, like, that's certainly something, but it's neither particularly principled nor is it particularly aloof. This is someone who seems never happier than to mix it up and to get into fights.
He cares very deeply about people who he also professes to see as his inferiors, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, this is a guy who will put a lot of stock into the tweets of a 26-year-old with 500 followers.
Yeah.
And who might assemble a little dossier of those tweets and then send them out to anybody who might want to hire her. Yeah.
Oh, we'll get there. It's great. I'm sorry that happened to you.
Oh, no. I wound up fine.
But I think that gets us to a first article of his that I didn't know prior to researching this, which is called All Roads Lead to Nowhere.
Wait. This is so funny. This is like one of his bits, which is that he's aggressively British.
That's right.
And, like, so snobby in a really pointed, over-the-top way.
Yeah, so this is him dumping on Rhodes Scholars?
He hates Rhodes Scholars.
In some ways, also his kiss off to academia. It is a look at these pointy-headed idiots, right, who aren't interesting. Like, it's a first sort of self-articulation of what he will do differently from them.
Is this when the guy with degrees from Oxford and Harvard makes a mockery of the out-of-touch elites?
No, but it's also like the wrong elites, right?
He says that they're lower tier, right? He's like, they're not actually good enough for this.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, he does seem to have a sense of there's a natural hierarchy and it is not the one that's represented, in this case, on the campus. And I think that this all kind of hangs together. Like, there is, on the one hand, this eligibility of UK class distinction to American audiences, right? Like, this is something that Brits, I feel like, frankly, exploit a lot in the US, which is that, like, they come out of a system in which you locate yourself the moment you open your mouth and people know exactly where you went and what you did.
Yes.
And you come across the pond and everyone's, oh, how fancy.
Yes. Which also allows them to disappear their class privilege as well at times, right, or enhance their sense of, like, elite credibility at other times. There's, like, micro gradations of class distinction that are legible to a British ear that make no sense to an American.
I still think that he hit some sort of limit at Oxford, right? Like, he could have swum in the Tory gay mainstream the way a character in an Alan Hollingshurst novel would, but that was not what he did. It's noticeable that he emerges onto the US scene with a really white hot hatred for outing. And I'm like, huh, I wonder if there's any connection there.
Let's just make the implicit explicit. You think that he was outed at Oxford and that this destroyed his career ambitions. I will say, like, one complicating factor is that Andrew Sullivan was writing about American politics for a British audience before he came to the US.
That's true.
So he already had at least one foot in this puddle. And sometimes British people come to the US thinking that they're going to be in a bigger pond. They're thinking, like, I'm going to go where the real action is and leave what is now like a sort of like provincial island. I think this is something that Americans are increasingly going to be doing too.
On the outing stuff, right? Like, he comes to the US and he realizes that outing is by that point a mostly left-wing activity. Right.
This is a tactic engaged in by gay rights activists, particularly by like HIV AIDS activists.
That's right.
To try and elicit change by pointing out the hypocrisy of powerful closeted people, which was a robust tradition on the American right.
That's right. And it's noticeable that, like, a lot of time when you get to Sullivan's very strange sort of horseshoe theorizing, where it's the extreme right and the extreme left, if you basically substitute like the masthead of the Village Voice, that's it. He's basically like, the lefties do what right-wing Tories do in the UK. That appears to be the experiential core of this habit of his, to be like, this is where the far right and the far left meet. And far left just means people who are more out than you are.
Right is like focus on the family.
Yeah.
And like personally Jesse Helms and people with a lot of money and seats of actual power. And the far left is, you know, a couple of guys in ACT UP.
Yeah.
The equivalence of things that are actually very asymmetrical is a recurring theme in his thought that I think has been very influential for subsequent reactionary centrists.
Yeah, that's right.
Although and there's a bit of a misnomer because Andrew Sullivan is a true conservative.
The other thing that All Roads to Nowhere got me to realize is that with fascinations with race and IQ, that it's like a political ideology, but it's also part of a personality structure, isn't it? It's like the kind of person who somehow needs this to be true. And I think you get the impression, even from this early text, that Andrew Sullivan is just the kind of person who needs this to be true. He's obsessed with hierarchies. He has, as you said, with the comprehensive school of his childhood, he has a real hatred for the breaking down of distinctions, right?
But he's also got a deep investment in the notion that those hierarchies are biological, pre-social,
exactly,
not historically conditioned. He's like, no, this is something that we are born into. It is fixed. It is fate. Yeah.
And monkeying with them is bad, right? Because he's benefited from them. And so if monkeying with them were good, it would mean that he just played a meaningless game, which, like, don't know what to tell you. You went to Harvard University. That was your choice.
I mean, I don't want to get ahead of us, but this is the thesis of the bell curve, right? Not just that some races are intellectually superior to others, but therefore welfare programs are a waste,
right?
Because they're just encouraging people who are not genetically fit to survive.
To jump ahead both in the discussion briefly, we'll get to it again, as you say, and to jump ahead in our release schedule, because this is a point that Quinn Sobodian makes in his very interesting chapter on IQ in his new book, Hayek's Bastards, which we're going to do an episode on very soon. Quinn points out that this kind of IQ stuff becomes important in two places, right? The UK in the 70s around sort of school streaming, and then again around the bell curve and anti-affirmative action stuff in the 90s. And Sullivan is like the rare person who's participated in both.
In malevolent Forrest Gump, he's everywhere.
So moving on, he writes this first article. He then briefly writes for The Telegraph, apparently, and then for The New Republic on an internship. Now, Moira, what can you tell us about The New Republic?
The New Republic is quite an old politics magazine. It was at the time based in DC, and it was more or less just about national politics. And it was considered like the in-flight magazine of Air Force One. I think this was the time when it had that moniker. Mm-hmm. It was in this era, like, very self-consciously centrist, maybe possibly a little bit center-right. And this is when it was under the directorship of a very influential editor named Marty Peretz.
Yeah, owner, right?
Owner, yep.
Who had fired a previous editor for not publishing his articles.
Yep, yep. Very classic.
Marty Peretz, very importantly, like Andrew Sullivan, a gay man, although it didn't keep him from marrying several, question mark, several, I think, heiresses.
Yes, he married rich women, blew all their money on TNR, and then threw them away like tissues. Yes.
Nice. I believe he then decamped eventually with a IDF boy toy to the Middle East. He bought the New Republic in 1975, and he was part of what moved this magazine, as you say, to the center, shading into center right. And he also said a bunch of racist shit, published his own terrible articles there.
But also he had a particular hiring style, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like J. Edgar Hoover at the FBI, TNR editors in the 80s had a certain look, and they tended to be white, male, young, and beautiful. What was the like line about the British guy who looks around the offices of TNR and is, oh, it's like being at some like famous gay gym?
Peretz definitely had a type. This is also, I think, when Stephen Glass first got hired.
On virtue of his jawline, yes.
The second most embarrassing moment in the history of that august publication, the first being obviously publishing my article.
No, the first we're going to get to.
Oh, yeah.
Because Andrew Sullivan quickly ingratiates himself with Peretz and winds up, within a pretty short period of time, being the head of TNR at a pretty young age still.
Oh, yeah. 30, younger than 30. Yeah, and he uses this perch at the New Republic to really write what I think were pretty unprecedented essays about gay life for, as you say, the in-flight magazine of Air Force One. These are texts that he writes as a gay man very explicitly. He says, like, my friend, right? He's not like, you know, we met these homosexuals at the local bar and they told us this. He says, I am a gay man and that's why I'm writing about these people. A lot of it was path-breaking in terms of looking forward, especially the gay marriage stuff. As you say, 1989 cover story. I think the article itself is called Here Comes the Groom, but basically it's known as the case for gay marriage. But he also takes stock of the AIDS crisis in a way that I think very few publications at the time did. There's an essay from 1990 called Gay Life, Gay Death that we might want to talk about, partly because this one's not one where we're going to be like, LOL, what a jerk. But this is just like why people take this guy seriously sometimes. Like I think it's a pretty beautiful piece. It has its problems, but it's still quite a remarkable piece.
Part of what is frustrating about Andrew Sullivan is that when he's looking at people who remind him of himself in some way, he can write with quite beautiful empathy, right?
Yeah.
So he writes in this piece, Gay Life and Gay Death, largely invisible and almost incomprehensible to outsiders, gay men and their families now live lives alien to modernity's rhythms. Death is ubiquitous. Friends and lovers die with random, rapid consistency. Time horizons shorten. Death is mentionable again. Indeed, it is unavoidable. Gay men now live essentially as medievals among moderns, habituated to mortality in a world of health, besieged by death in the midst of obvious life.
It's an incredible passage. And this idea of oblivious life, I think, like he's raging against this kind of Reaganite consensus that basically this isn't really worth talking about. Still, I think in an interview with Anderson Cooper a couple of years ago, he makes the obvious comparison to Vietnam. And he's like, more people were dying that decade than did in Vietnam, but it just didn't happen to the same Americans.
It happened to gay men as gay men and drug users as drug users, right? Yeah. And these were or identities that were discarded as outside of the respectable vision of like American aspiration, right? And that is something that he was able to see the injustice of, which is why it is enraging that he cannot apply that same logic to other fights.
Yeah.
But I do want to dwell for a minute on this moment of gay conservative reckoning with AIDS, right? Because what AIDS did was make explicit this cleavage within the gay community of like different ways of responding to the AIDS crisis, right?
Yeah.
And one way that I think Andrew Sullivan really typifies was a move towards social conservatism. You could see a gay man of Andrew Sullivan's generation being drawn to the right basically through libertarianism, right? Like, leave us alone, stop raiding our bars, like, get the government out of my bedroom, that kind of stuff, which is a line that Andrew Sullivan will take subsequently, but that's not really what he does in the wake of the AIDS crisis. What he does in the wake of the AIDS crisis is go much more in like a gay version of social conservatism,
yeah.
right? A gay version of an assimilationist, pro-family, anti-promiscuity vision of gay life that tries to make gay life almost as a retreat from AIDS into like as close as possible a mimicry of straight life, right?
Yeah.
And this is where I think he becomes most passionate about gay marriage.
Yeah.
Not as a matter of like dignity for an oppressed minority, not as a matter of the evolution of the institution of marriage to be more encompassing of like relations of equality, but about making gay people something different than they were at the time.
And that's, of course, what's happening in the famous 1989 text on the case for gay marriage. He does two things, right? On the one hand, he's saying he's trying to put the issue of gay marriage on the front burner. He's trying to say this will, to some extent, solve some of these problems and it addresses some of the iniquities that the AIDS crisis has brought to the fore. At the same time, he's also not so subtly chiding the gay movement for not attending to this enough. As with Gay Life, Gay Death, frankly, we'll get back to that in a second. There is a very beautiful part to that argument where he's like passionately pleading for dignity in a way that would literally find its way into the majority opinion of Anthony Kennedy, another conservative Catholic in the Obergefell decision, almost 30 years later. But on the other hand, like there is this less remembered part to both of these texts where it's like, well, activists are doing it wrong. He's saying the gay movement should really focus on gay marriage and gays in the military. And for those of our listeners who are too young to remember, that is pretty much exactly what happened. That's important. That this man who keeps beating up on the gay movement shaped what it did for like 20 years. Yeah. You got
your wish. Abandoned other projects to yes. do this, not just AIDS research, which he sort of declared was no longer necessary in 1996, but also like non-discrimination in employment. That was the big gay movement legal push beforehand. And then it became marriage largely due to the intervention of people like Andrew Sullivan.
That's right. On the one hand, he makes an argument that the reason gay marriage isn't enough of a topic is that gay people haven't chosen to make it one. Now, you might say like, well, yeah, because it turns out when you did, conservatives ran on that and like won a bunch of elections. Like it could have been smart to be like, maybe we just shouldn't die and be discriminated against. Feels like this is down the line kind of thing. Like who knows? You can have a debate about that, but that's not how he sees it. He thinks the reason that queers didn't go for gay marriage is that they were too libertine and too in love with being not normal man and whatever. And it's like, yeah, whatever, go hippie punch someone else. Like, this is so stupid. Like, of course that exists. Like, that Michel Foucault was probably not a huge proponent of gay marriage, I'll allow. But like, fuck off.
When I was a young gay person, once upon a time, the people giving us lectures about how marriage was the wrong goal were like a fringe group of like septum piercing kids from Oberlin.
Yeah.
And there were maybe 2,000 of them in the whole
yeah.
country. And Andrew Sullivan blows up their influence. Like this is a guy whose whole political philosophy is about incrementalism and quietism and passivity. Now with this issue, taking up a really maximalist outsider stance
yeah.
when he first advances it in the late 80s. And that is very revealing to me,
yeah.
right? Because I think it shows what his actual beliefs are, which are less about passivity than like affirmative investment in hierarchy, right? The things that he says the radical queers don't like about marriage are the things that he does like about marriage. He's admitting his own investments by like strawmanning a supposed opposition that didn't yeah. really exist.
Yeah, these are the kinds of arguments you would encounter in grad school, but not even, and here it comes, in the kind of grad school he attended. Like, if he'd gotten a PhD in comparative literature, sure. But he didn't even do that. It's like you had to look these people up in order to find them and to disagree with them. See, he says, for instance, in the case for gay marriage, Quote, the gay movement has ducked this issue primarily out of fear of division. Much of the gay leadership clings to notions of gay life as essentially outsider, anti-bourgeois, and radical. Marriage for them is co-optation into straight society. That's the transition that he's tracing here. And that's the transition that is supposed to be effectuated by the push for gay marriage. A need to rebel has quietly ceded to a desire to belong. To be gay and to be bourgeois no longer seem like such an absurd proposition. Certainly since AIDS, to be gay and to be responsible has become a necessity. So he's like, we used to be run by these crazy screaming queens, and now we're going to be run by the adults in the room, right? Our friends over at Bad Gays, who devoted only the fifth episode ever to Andrew Sullivan, do point out that, like, this is just a massive, it's a great episode, people should check it out. It's just a massive call for demobilization, right? Stop yelling about income inequality. Stop yelling about rents. Stop yelling about healthcare access. Start yelling about, I want to have an easier time inheriting my boyfriend's Hamptons home, right?
It's a outsider political demand at this moment in history. It genuinely is. Give him credit where it's due.
Yeah.
But he comes to it because he wants to circumscribe the ambition of the gay movement, right? He wants gay rights to be about, like, private sphere license in a libertarian model, in this realm anyway, about the ability to assimilate into rather than challenge a big hierarchy. I think that something that is really consistent about Andrew Sullivan's thought is he does not follow self-interest down to an underlying principle that would implicate other people, right? Or implicate him in responsibility to other people. So, like, one thing that is, I think, very telling will be his later opposition to, like, a lot of trans rights discourses. Like, he is very opposed to the notion that cisgender gay people and trans people have something in common, right? Let alone that, like, gay people and, like, cis feminists might have something in common, right? This is a sort of division, walling, almost like besieged mentality about a very small conceptual terrain whose borders he's very fiercely defending.
Yeah. We've alluded to this a couple of times. I think we'll talk more about it later. It must have a lot to do with the fact that AIDS was an experience that gay cis men took to be centering them and not others, right? I mean, that's partly true, partly not true, but whatever the case, they understood this to be their particular plight and for it to detach them kind of from the rest of the umbrella. I think it's so right what you're saying. It doesn't just curtail what the movement should ask for, it curtails who belongs in the movement at all, right? It's saying, like, some people's concerns, insofar as they do not overlap with what he's talking about, a bourgeois responsibility, really ought not to be part of it at all. We should shunt them aside. Well, that's, yeah, that isn't indeed what happened. And in some way, someone like him should probably answer for that. The other thing that I thought was genuinely interesting, he makes the point early on in that 89 essay, and he makes it again, I believe, in Virtually Normal, that this kind of odd hybrid construction of the domestic partnership or whatever it's called, civil union, or different versions of these kind of fake marriages emerged in order to square the circle. And as you say, like, his radicalism is to say that's bullshit. Yeah. And his grounds for it are really interesting because they are both Catholic and natural law and kind of radical. Because it's or libertarian. Explain. Well, it's about privacy. He says in a domestic partnership arrangement, you're making something explicit. Marriage is a sacrament. It is a mystery what exactly it means. Oh, you're married, what does that mean? Is no one's question to ask. And he says the moment it becomes someone's business to ask what it is, well, then it is less dignified. It's losing that kind of weak theological dignity that it has even in its civil form, which I think is a kind of a cool argument.
As a radical feminist, I hear this. And who's to say that marriage doesn't endow me with the right to beat my wife?
Right.
You know, like like we need to draw a shroud over the private sphere and not allow either outside critique of other people or, like, any kind of obligation to the law to interfere with this special privacy realm is a recipe for abuse, right? Because where there is no law, the strong rule, and who tends to be most strong versus most weak in a home is a very gendered question.
Sorry, I thought you were asking a different question. Sorry. I was speaking as but Andrew Sullivan here, yeah.
I have also noticed about Andrew Sullivan in particular is that whenever he refers to gay marriage, he always qualifies it as civil marriage. He's got this, like, almost hands-up defensiveness and, like, deferentialness to the religious marriages from which he and, like, us are excluded. Like,
yeah.
He is being very, very specific about what he means in a way that almost seems meant to, as a lot of the kind of marriage activism he was participating in the 90s was meant to be, like, almost obsessively non-threatening to the Christian right.
Yeah, that's another point that we'll have to make when we get to Virtually Normal, which can be a really baffling book until you realize it's not written with you and me in mind. It's not meant to convince gay people. This was from a time when, I guess, ostensibly social conservatives still read books written by people who were not complete psychopaths.
Are we calling Andrew Sullivan not a complete psychopath?
Okay, fine. But I think there's no way that a televangelist today would be reading a book written by David Brooks. This is a book addressed to fellow conservatives. This is his pitch to fellow conservatives to get on board with this project. It's not pitched at us, and this article probably isn't either.
Look, I can lead the way in assimilating this group of people who you don't like because they're not domesticated, like quite literally domesticated, right? Yeah. Like cats. We're going to put them in the home and we're going to give them a nice little, like, leave it to Beaver with his and his instead of his and hers, right? The vision of marriage that Andrew Sullivan was proposing for gay people in the 1990s is something that it had long since stopped being for straight people. The thing about gay marriage is that in reality, gay marriage became thinkable because straight marriage had ceased to be as uniform and effective tool of social control of women, right? And it became something that was more accommodating towards these partnerships of equals rather than a property relation of one person over another. And Andrew Sullivan is like offering to evangelicals a vision of marriage that turns back the clock on their own straight marriages, right?
Nice. Yeah, as you say, he's doing something quite radical, and like props to him to some extent. But he then almost reflexively flips to like, oh, the reason you don't have it is because of the sex radicals. And you get this in Gay Life, Gay Death as well, where he does these very interesting kind of observations about gay activism, basically. And it's really interesting that this text kind of alternates between really, as you say, beautifully empathetic passages about individual sufferers, including from all races and backgrounds. He's very careful not to just interview the kinds of people that show up at ACT UP meetings. Like, that's great. To these kind of long passages where you can just tell he just doesn't like those activists. He doesn't like the way they talk about AIDS. He doesn't like the way ACT UP confronts people. He doesn't like the protests they did in churches. He's annoyed about the fact that ACT UP uses outing. I'll give you one example. In the hands of OutWeek, a new magazine closely allied to ACT UP, outing has become a way of enforcing ideological conformity on illiberal lines. Like, this is just an anti-PC screed.
Right. And it speaks to the same notion that sex should be private and like beyond anybody else's critique, which is hostile both to like feminist and to like radical queer visions. No, sexuality is actually implicated in politics. It's used to limit certain kinds of freedom and repress certain kinds of people. And what he wants is sex completely insulated from politics, which makes sense if you're a gay conservative, right? Yeah. If you want to be like, no, this part of my life doesn't count. Do not look behind this velvet rope I've put up, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. Like, none of this counts.
At the same time, I mean, this is someone who does openly write as a gay man and even comes out about his HIV status at a time when that was definitely not self-understood. At the same time, So I think my problem with this is not so much that it's convenient. It is. I think you're right. It's that it's internally incoherent, right? You may dislike people outing other people. I'm not sure how I feel about that practice, to be honest. It enforces ideological conformity on liberal lines. Right. It is in many ways like Stalinism. Many have said so, right? It gets to the point where where in Virtually Normal, he blames Michel Foucault for like the practice of outing. And I'm like, wait.
There's some things to blame Michel Foucault for, but I just don't know about that.
Like, look, like by his own admission, Foucault, as a post-structuralist thinker, didn't think there was a true sexuality to be revealed in outing. It would make no fucking sense. Like, that's what outing is. It's like, Foucault deep down, this like, guy is a gay man. That's what outing says, right?
To reveal an inherent truth, which Andrew Sullivan believes in, and Michel Foucault, as a like post-structuralist, does not. Yeah, no, I do want to see this vision of these two bald guys, like one smart, one dumb, just trying to like make themselves understood to one another.
Both with accents that Americans are primed to read as highly intelligent. But maybe we'll get back to Virtually Normal, which will rehearse some of these arguments again in 1995. But first, we got to talk about what happens in 1994.
Oh, God.
The bell curve. For whom the bell curve tolls. Yes.
So for those who are privileged not to be familiar, The Bell Curve was a book published in 1994. It was third by Charles Murray and a guy named Richard Herrnstein, who tends to get forgotten in the story largely because he died right before the book came out. And it is a race science book. Yeah. Argued that group differences in IQ, like tested measured IQ, differ along ethnic, racial, and gender lines, and that these different test results between men and women, between white people, black people, Asian people, reveal a natural racial hierarchy of intelligence. I believe they said that at the top of the hierarchy was like Han Chinese people and Ashkenazi Jews.
That's right.
Correctly, and at the bottom of this hierarchy is, of course, black people.
So it can't be racist because we're singling out Jews and Asians.
Yeah. Whenever anybody has a broad pronouncement to make about the Jews, you know it's going to go great.
Yeah. And you know it's an AI trained on Twitter.
So Andrew Sullivan was, and I must say, completely unprompted, a very, very big proponent of this book. In particular, he was a big proponent of what has now gotten termed like the race realist assertions of this book, right? So these people who claim that this, and I have to really emphasize, like repeatedly and thoroughly empirically debunked data reveals this underlying fact about hierarchies being ordained by a kind of like fate that is cemented in biology or nature. And that because this is nominally grounded in numbers, which again have been debunked, that it's somehow not bigotry, that it's somehow just a like mere scientific revelation of reality.
Well, and more, it's a corrective to sort of liberal wishful thinking, right? That fails. Right, right. To grapple with what's ultimately the thesis of the bell curve, which is the biological impossibility of multiculturalism, right? Like the way affirmative action programs, the way American society sought to remake itself across color lines, basically in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, was doomed to failure due to the, you know, bedrock biological origin of all these distinctions, right?
And therefore, aspirations to equality that we might try and express through like a constitutional form of government or through the law or through redistribution, these are not just like misguided, but they're unnatural, right? They're contrary to the law of nature and by extension, the law of God.
Yeah. And I mean, Sullivan, I think, is very strongly invested in the sort of anti-affirmative action part of the Murray-Herrnstein argument. The other one, of course, is about mass incarceration. That basically, the bell curve is saying mass incarceration is inevitable and will inevitably target African Americans. I don't know if he's, I think for him, again, like this is probably a guy who doesn't go to prison that often, but goes to Harvard quite a lot. He's really upset about someone who might be in his graduate program who he feels doesn't belong there. That's the world where he encounters IQ differences or what he thinks are IQ differences.
Still mad that he had to share a classroom or was threatened with having to share a classroom with the proles back in Surrey. Sometimes in our discussions of American politics, people will make a distinction between like genteel racism and what they call gutter racism, right? And I think that Andrew Sullivan, who excerpts the bell curve in The New Republic, when it is published, who puts the bell curve on the cover of the New Republic, who repeatedly overrules the objections of like basically the entire editorial staff at the New Republic to do so, and has been defending this choice for 30 years since, reveals that there's not actually a meaningful distinction between gutter and genteel racism, right? This is a very fancy guy motivated by rank bigotry and a sense of his own superiority that is just bone deep.
Yeah, he wrote, I think, in like the 2010s, "One of my proudest moments in journalism was publishing an expanded extract of a chapter from The Bell Curve in the New Republic before anyone else dared touch it." And that's a fascinating version of history, Andrew, because on the one hand, nobody would touch it. This thing sold 400,000 fucking copies, first off. It was definitely taken seriously by people who should have known better. Sure, as you say, you put a further genteel sheen on it. You slathered some lipstick on it. Great. But this thing was getting read. And of course, it aligned with policy preferences of half the fucking country. And it gave a biologistic sheen to them. Of course they were going to like that. Of course they were going to go for it. Like, it wasn't courageous to put that out there. You did a head fake to the right where it cost you nothing and where it aligned with your priors. Also, like, one of my proudest moments in journalism, it's like, you Xeroxed a... Like, I mean, I've done excerpts of my books.
Running an excerpt of a book is not like reporting out a feature, but
you might run one extra level of fact checking. You might do some light edits, but this isn't like exactly I blew open this massive scandal.
I've got to be real with you. I'm not sure anybody fact checked the bell curve, but this is the thing he does all the time. This is a reactionary centrist position of triumphant woundedness, right? He takes the objection to his conduct as evidence of principle.
Yeah.
Rather than admitting to self-interest or self-gratification, which I think is pretty abundantly evident in the decision to publish this extract, he disguises it with supposed commitments to free speech or to using people's objection as a sign of how correct he is. Yeah. It's the classic tweet that's like, "Keep yelling, shut the fuck up at me. It only makes my opinions worse," right? He's like, the fact that everybody disagrees with me is not evidence that I could be wrong, or that people with whom I profess to share values are disagreeing with me is not evidence that maybe I should reconsider this position. It's evidence of my courage. It's evidence that I am willing to say what no one else is willing to say. And the taboo, or supposed taboo, against this is seen as proof itself of its validity.
Yeah. He says in that piece I just quoted, right, "I published it, the bell curve, or the chapter from the bell curve, along with multiple critiques. Hey, I believe magazines were supposed to open rather than close debates."
What actually happened is that all of his staff threatened to fucking resign if he didn't run in print at length their objections to this excerpt.
Yeah. He allegedly wanted to start a debate, but he's spent the last 30 years basically insisting that the debate that then ensued, where everyone was like, "These people are wrong, by the way," including, as you say, his own staff writers, is basically the wrong debate to have too. Like, apparently, like, that's not a real debate, which is like such a kind of today Bari Weiss, Yasha Munk, like they all do this. He says, "The fact that so many liberals are determined instead to prevent and stigmatize free research and debate on this subject is evidence, well, that they have ceased to be liberals in the classic sense." Oh, and it's like, God. No, you published horseshit research and people were like, "Hey, that's horseshit research. Here are our reasons." I think it's the American Psychological Association, like one of the big professional organizations, like did a dossier just being like, "Hey, here are all the problems with this data." It's like, that's debate. That's the debate you ostensibly wanted. But no, it's a sign that they were illiberal. So it's okay, the debate that you claim to promote is also the debate you didn't want to be having. And like the moment someone was starting to have them, including in your own magazine, you got butthurt over it and retreated into like your little pouty corner.
You know, it's a similar gesture to what Clarence Thomas did in his concurrence to Scrimeti, which hopefully we'll also get to talk about on a future episode, which is like this list of all the people with medical and psychological credentials telling him that he was wrong, and then just an attack on the feature of intellectual credential whatsoever. He's like, the experts are actually just biased and they're afraid of me telling the truth. And it's, no, you're wrong. This is like the people with more information than you just disagree.
Yeah. And I mean, his expertise appeared to be entirely drawn from like Facebook posts and like blogs. And it's like, I don't know, Clarence, like it doesn't feel like this is your thinking either. It's just like, I guess you follow J.K. Rowling. It's just like the so-called experts. Like, here's my expert, the lady who invented the word Hufflepuff. So moving on from the bell curve, like, it's important to note that we're going to go back to homosexuality now and his book Virtually Normal. And it's important to note that while he's doing all this, while he's fighting the TNR staff, et cetera, it's clearly a moment when he feels himself beleaguered in another way, having to do with homosexuality. And I think that's not an accident. There is a weird way, you've already alluded to this, where his defensiveness as a gay man and his defensiveness as just kind of a petulant jerk kind of fall into one, but they're not the same thing. He, I think, fails to distinguish between the two, but one is a lot more moving and understandable, I think, than the other, frankly. He's writing all this stuff about homosexuality in the midst of losing just basically one friend after the other to AIDS. And again, if you listen to him talk about this today, he still audibly tears up. It's just like he's choked with rage and with loss. There's a beautiful book by Sarah Schulman. I think it's called
Gentrification of the Mind.
Gentrification of the Mind.
An absolutely gorgeous book.
Yeah.
About the AIDS crisis in New York City.
Yeah. Where she has these two or three chapters in the middle where she just lists the people and like kind of imagines what they would have done. And you get a feeling that Sullivan thinks the same way. He's like, someone who dies at 30, who's so smart and funny and interesting and doing these cool things, like, what would they have gotten up to? We never get to find out. And as they say, the band played on. It's as though this didn't happen. And you can tell that he's just choked with rage over that. And hardly argue with this.
This is also a time when he is acutely aware of this vulnerability, not just among presumably friends and lovers and the kinds of community members he's losing to AIDS, but also himself. He is by now infected. And is that public information or is he keeping that secret?
He goes public about that fairly early on, I think, not immediately. But his HIV journey appears to have been, I think he said in an interview with Anderson Cooper, that he found out he's HIV positive in 1993. He goes on those very early drug regimen, which are awful, right? Like it's like
the AZT.
Yeah, I think so.
The early drugs to treat AIDS were physically quite punishing and didn't do much at all.
Yeah, but by 1996, it appears to be that his viral load is undetectable. But it's important, right? Like Virtually Normal comes out in 1995, I believe, meaning he still wrote that book thinking there was a good chance that this was going to be one of the last things he'd write before he died. And luckily that didn't end up happening.
Mm. So there's this moment here where I want us to dwell on this and maybe give a little more like psychological generosity to Andrew Sullivan than I think he would give to us, which is that this is a guy who is motivated clearly in many instances by hate, by supremacy, by a sense of like the fixedness of our destinies. And he's getting this flash of how unfair that is.
Yeah.
Right? Like if you believe, as Andrew Sullivan does, that being gay is this biological difference to which you are fated, then the notion that that almost randomness of your fate would lead you into this kind of vulnerability is so wildly unfair, right? And you can see in things like Virtually Normal, in like his broader effort to use the AIDS crisis as a means to like change gay culture, this effort to make HIV and death of AIDS like less random, to make it like something that is, it's almost a reach for control, right? What if we all settle down and get married and stop having sex at these bathhouses? Like maybe then we can survive, right? There's an impulse there. Like, this is a guy who's full of malice, right? But I can see something more human at the bottom there.
Yeah. Even his recollections of the AIDS era are laced with this kind of resentment as well, which again, it's not unique to Sullivan, frankly, and it's understandable, frankly. It's a understandable resentment to have lost all these people and to feel like the culture moved on. But the main thing is, of course, other gays moved on, right? It's the younger gays that moved on. He points out that the victory was, quote, a very tainted one, right? With even the ones who survived being absolutely messed up by it. But he's also kind of possessive about the experience, upset that sort of younger gays and presumably other groups within the LGBT umbrella don't care anymore, right? That's really a common complaint in that generation, I think, and it is in its own way both understandable and kind of conservative. It takes ownership of this identity and starts policing it out of, as you say, out of a woundedness that is perfectly understandable, but that nevertheless, I think, amounts to withdrawal of empathy, right? The thing you've been describing where he cannot somehow make the leap that other people deserve liberation in exactly the same way he deserves liberation, that other people deserve to live the same way his friends deserve to live. Like the fact that he cannot make that leap, there is a narcissistic wound at the center of it. And I don't mean narcissistic here. I mean it diagnostically, not as a value judgment. I get it. Like these are people, you close your eyes at night and you see them. Like obviously they're going to be closer to you. I totally get that. But it does blind you to things. I think it creates massive blind spots. And unfortunately, he's been dwelling in those for the last 25 years, 30 years.
One way to deal with grief that I think is maybe not always useful, but is to me understandable, is to get mad at the dead, right? How dare you leave me? You were irresponsible. You should have worn a condom. Now you've abandoned me to live without you, is something that I could see a gay man of Sullivan's generation enduring. Another way to deal with grief or to deal with the aftermath of your suffering is to resent those who don't have to suffer the same way.
Yeah,
this was a big recurring theme in Me Too, where older women who had endured like almost incessant sexual harassment when they entered the workforce were like, what do you mean you want us to change the world because you can't handle your boss grabbing your ass? To which the answer from younger women is like, well, yes. But the sense of like, my suffering has ennobled me, or it has given me this legitimacy that these coddled younger people haven't earned, and I am not being recognized for my status as somebody who has suffered, is I think also like a feeling that can drive people towards conservative politics. Because when younger generations come around, and maybe they were never dating in an era when you couldn't be out at work, maybe they were dating in an era where you couldn't get married, maybe they were never having sex and having to worry that the sex that they were having would also get them or somebody else killed. That is something that can seem, and I mean this in the way like of judgment, it can seem like privilege, right? It can seem like an obliviousness to the realities of the world and an ease in the world that I think it's very easy to resent.
Maybe we'll get to the book that sort of comes out of this crucible, both of AIDS, of the gay marriage debate, and sort of like what the steps after AIDS might be like, which is Virtually Normal, An Argument About Homosexuality from 1995. And I think that gives you a good sense of where Sullivan sees himself in terms of his political project. And it's helpful for people living in the wake of Obergefell, et cetera, just get a sense of the ideological extraction of that push. Like, where did it come from? And I think Moore has already been alluding to this, but it might be worth pointing this out in detail. So he distinguishes four ways of approaching homosexuality through public policy. The first is prohibitionism, very easy to define, right? There is no difference between homosexual acts and homosexual orientation. Right? You aren't homosexual, you just choose to commit these kinds of acts. I think he draws this back to St. Thomas Aquinas, right?
So many bad things get drawn back to St. Thomas Aquinas. We're going to have to do an Aquinas episode.
We are.
Wait,
summer.
Really?
Natural law.
Oh my
law.
God.
It's all Aquinas.
Yes. Okay. All right.
God, summer I've been reading the Summa Theologica for like a year.
Hot Aquinas summer. I love it. Aquinas summer. No, we're going to have so much fun blaming him for so much.
We're doing so much.
We're doing that guy.
And Schlafly. We're doing them all.
We're doing them all. Our white whales.
And he talks about conservatism, right? Which is basically, he says, quote, disapproving of public homosexuals, but approving of private ones. The idea that the public dimension of homosexuality poses a threat to heterosexual marriage and basically destroys social cohesion.
You say that like it's a bad thing.
But it's a very common argument, right? That you don't want to prohibit homosexuality, but you have some notion that some things are promoting it and you want to cut down on the promotion of it. The examples of this are kind of weird. This becomes a more common view on the right as gay marriage becomes more of a reality. By 1995, there aren't many people arguing about this. His example, I think, is John Finnis, who is Neil Gorsuch's dissertation advisor.
I know, in the sort of end of term tea leave reading that people do about the Supreme Court justices, one thing that always comes up is that Neil Gorsuch was very close with this gay mentor, and maybe that's why he wrote Bostock, but then why'd he vote the way he did in Scrimeti? Because these guys have so much unaccountable power, we wind up doing shit like this, being like, oh, it's all about his feelings, determine whether or not we have rights.
Which is true. Great system you got there. Where like 10 decaying brains get to decide whether you have rights or not.
But this is something that gay conservatives do point to, is these gay, like really only men who were like quasi-closeted over the course of the conservative tradition.
The next option that he talks about in terms of how public policy and homosexuality can be said to relate is liberalism. This is basically... it's kind of a misnomer. He's thinking of like the human rights campaign, right? The idea of using the civil rights regime to secure gay rights.
How dare they? I know.
I know.
You want a non-discrimination in housing provision. Like you want non-discrimination in employment, which is what HRC was working on for a long time.
Yeah.
But then all these institutions reoriented themselves not long after he wrote this book towards his hobby horse of gay marriage.
That's right.
Right? This is how he got what he wanted, was through civil rights and civil rights litigation.
That's right. Which he now thinks the gay rights movement has gone off the rails again because it did other things after that. But in each case, he does this debate society thing where he points out that there are inconsistencies in each of these views. The prohibitionists have to say this about procreation, and it's very obvious. Philosophers have been pointing this out for hundreds of years, that old people can get married who will not procreate. We don't check whether people can or have the intention to procreate before we let them get married. So clearly that doesn't work. The problem with the conservative case, he thinks, is ultimately that it both can't articulate why treating gay people with dignity would rend the social fabric. And the problem with liberalism is basically that homophobes would feel they're forced to support something that they don't, which is an argument that, like,
now very popular on the Supreme Court as
that's
well.
Right.
This notion that homophobes have been oppressed by gay marriage. Yes.
By the possibility that America's homophobic web designers live in constant fear of that phone ringing and being like, can you make me a wedding website?
Well, this is also a recurring theme of Andrew Sullivan's thought, the fact that he equates, on the one hand, like legal repression of vulnerable minorities, particularly like gay and queer people, to like the social disapproval that homophobes and other bigots might feel by an occasional liberal, right? Like that these are supposed to be equal in like weight and consideration as we like evaluate competing interests is, oh, you might be oppressed by the state versus, oh, somebody might tell you that you're an asshole for doing what you're doing.
Exactly. And then the final approach is what he calls liberationism, meaning I think he's mostly arguing with like ACT UP, again, queer theory, and, you know, I'll put an air horn in here, Michel Foucault. God damn it. Anyway, I was told there'd be no Foucault in this episode.
He's come up twice.
I know.
There's a specter haunting in Bed with the Right.
And I know. Get out of my brain, Michelle. But, so there are three things about this particular, right? So this is you can imagine that this book reserves a lot of ire for these people because these are the people that, frankly, he's
most annoyed by.
Yeah. Yeah. And he gravitates towards picking fights with them. As I say, the gay life, gay death moves from very moving descriptions of like, here's what being gay and living with HIV is like, to
being
like
annoyed at an opinion that maybe 100 people in the United States have. Yeah.
He's annoyed at one point in Gay Life, Gay Death about how democratic an ACT UP meeting was. And like people went on forever. And it's like, okay, so you just don't like activism.
You've never been to a community organizing meeting or any kind of activism meeting, like, ever. Like, this guy would go to the Park Slope Food Co-op and kill himself.
But also, like, come on. Like, you're saying these people are liberal, like, McCarthyites, but, you know, they're letting people talk way too much. Okay, pick a fucking lane, my friend.
They're both totalitarian and so inefficient.
Yeah. So three things about that. In a move that will come as a shock to exactly zero of our listeners, Sullivan proposes that this spectrum, right, running from prohibitionism to liberationism is actually, we're going to need another air horn here, a horseshoe.
Horseshoe.
Yeah, such that basically liberationists and prohibitionists actually secretly agree on the idea that there is no identity to sexuality. They're basically a reverse image of each other.
So it's like Michel Foucault took the long way around the barn and wound right up back at Thomas Aquinas.
Yeah, Sullivan is not unique in going down that particular rabbit hole. Like, this is, I think, what's behind Jürgen Habermas charging that Foucault is a neoconservative in the 1980s. It's a little weird to me.
But I mean, this goes back to Sullivan's investment in the fixity of identity. For him, homosexuality is only legitimate if it is not a choice. He has to be hashtag born this way. I'm sure he loved that Lady Gaga song that was everywhere in like 2015. It is legitimate if it is a spontaneous part of like natural human variation. It's not legitimate if it's a choice.
Right.
He seems very willing to concede that it would be a bad thing to choose.
Yeah, that's right. You got to be born this way. We can't put that needle drop in here. It's going to cost a fortune.
Oh my God. No, we'll just have to deal with, like, you all can hear it. Oh my God. What if we got sued by Lady Gaga?
I know. That would be the most hilarious way for an all-gay podcast to go.
It would be amazing for our download numbers, you got to say.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
We don't want Andrew Sullivan to sue us, but we do want Lady Gaga to sue us. Sue us, mistress.
Stephanie, call me.
Stephanie, dominate us. The other thing that's really telling is that, like, in another move that has become tiresomely familiar, Sullivan sort of takes this, what's essentially an academic position, right? Queer theory, essentially. And equates it to ACT UP, kind of activist position, where, like, there are overlaps, but they're definitely not... they're not the same. Two
very different projects.
Yes.
Like, queer theory is trying to publish something that will be a real barn burner in Science Journal. Like, they're trying, or like, that will annoy their three other academic rivals at other major institutions. And ACT UP is trying to change policy to lessen the suffering of actual people.
Yeah, queer theory takes itself to be reflecting on the struggle of activist groups like ACT UP. It's not to say that they don't agree on some things, but basically Sullivan wants to tie everything he doesn't like, outing, politically correct language policing, annoying activism, to basically liberationism, or what we would today call postmodernism. And there's a very nice review of the book by Kwame Anthony Appiah, who I know.
You do? I didn't know you.
Yeah, he and I got super drunk in Palo Alto once. I hope he wouldn't mind me saying that. We turn out both to be lightweights, but he was a lovely guy. He makes this point. It's like, I think his example is, a lot of queer theory is interrogating the identity categories from which activism could spring. And queer theory as such denies identity categories that you need if you politically organize. It's just weird to think that those two things are the same thing. They have to treat them, as you say, by their projects, by their respective projects, as different.
This is the same thing that they do now with What is a Woman, right? Like Matt Walsh,
yes.
Right? Like, because there are academic approaches to that question that conclude that the category is like functionally meaningless, right? Yeah. Or that you cannot actually find something that unites all the people who use it. And that can be used, if you really want it to, as I think like the likes of Matt Walsh do, to undermine any feminist claim, right?
Yeah.
But that is a different project than the feminist political project of trying to unite the shared interests of those who are living under that category.
Yeah.
They're different questions, right? I don't think it's like illegitimate to say, like, if you follow the question of what is a woman down to its absolute conclusion, it turns out to be pretty inconsistent. I just think that reveals something about gender.
Yeah, possibly.
That is not necessarily demobilizing politically the way somebody like Andrew Sullivan would, I think, want it to be.
Well, I also think these right wingers who nevertheless lay claim to these identities, right, do practice a very strange form of identity politics, I would say, in the sense that they approach, and I think Sullivan is very open in this whole thing in the spirit of an internal or an imminent critique, right? As one of us, I want to say this. Except, yes. as the quote from Richard Goldstein pointed out, like, ultimately, this isn't an internal critique. This is furnishing talking points to people who want to attack the gay movement. And it's different to say, to be like, yeah, Sarah Schulman at a meeting, be like, hey guys, I feel like we're doing too much of this. That's one thing. That's a pose that would be open to Andrew Sullivan, but that's clearly not the language game in which he's participating. If you're putting that in the New Republic, if you're putting it in a book that is very frankly pitching itself to conservatives, no, you are speaking the language of external critics, right? And I think that this kind of category confusion is absolutely central to the kind of rhetorical tricks that these kinds of...
We discussed this in our Pamela Paul episode as well, right? The sense of proposing an in-group critique that presumes... like acknowledgement of a shared position when that shared position might not actually be in evidence, right?
Yeah. I think it's basically what it is here would almost make the Corey Robin argument. It's abusing the fact that leftist spaces are in fact not ideological echo chambers, but are very discordant, and that internal critique is, unlike on the right, a very strong through line in leftist thinking. And it allows you to do this thing where you pretend to participate in an internal dialogue while secretly chiding, like, from the outside. And that kind of hopscotch where you're like, oh, am I inside? Am I outside? Like, oh, I'm so unknowable, right? Like, that is basically parasitically thriving off the very dynamism and internal contentiousness of leftist discourses that you claim to see no evidence of.
It simultaneously... labels these people as totalitarian, as hostile to critique, and then at the same time exploits and purports to be participating in their very tradition of like internal dissent.
That's right. And just to close out the things that he blames postmodernism for, postmodernism also caused AIDS, by the way.
Oh, of course it did. Great.
Yeah. This is from Love Undetectable. Quote, perhaps this too was a response to guilt. There is little doubt that the ideology that human beings are mere social constructions and that sex is beyond good and evil facilitated a world in which gay men literally killed each other by the thousands.
Oh, Jesus.
I know.
At some point in this era, maybe in Love Undetectable, he compares unprotected gay sex to murder, right?
That's right.
He says that it's morally equivalent to murder.
Yeah. Which would make later revelations kind of
very interesting. Yes.
So those are all the things that he thinks are wrong. What's his own solution? Well, it's basically laissez-faire homosexuality, right?
He basically winds up advocating, at least in terms of sexuality, the kind of like libertarianism that he accuses the like Foucauldian libertines of indulging in. This is actually like maybe a better description of his own position.
I think that's right. In his version, the government has to get rid of public as opposed to private discrimination.
I'm allowed to not like invite gay people to my party.
No. In relationships with the government, public citizens have to be treated the same, whether they're heterosexual or homosexual. He writes that basically he wants to extend every right and responsibility that heterosexuals enjoy as public citizens to be extended to those who grow up and find themselves different. And that is all.
So public citizens, as opposed to public consumers, as opposed to like members of a social world, right? That's not saying I want to change culture so that homosexuality becomes more acceptable, less foreign. It's not even saying I want public accommodation civil rights law to prevent the owner of a diner from kicking me and my boyfriend out. It's just saying I want the government to treat me exactly the same as it treats straight people.
I think that's how I read this too.
Which is conspicuous because his book, Virtually Normal, also focuses just on gay marriage and the military, which are government discriminations, right? These are when gay people were not allowed in the military. I believe it's around the time Don't Ask, Don't Tell became the policy, so they couldn't be out in the military. And it also comes out right before the Defense of Marriage Act, which is 1996.
That's right.
When the federal government explicitly states that it will not recognize any gay marriages that are performed in any of the states.
Yeah. So important interventions on both of those things, right? He's pushing back on things that have just happened. That's fair. At the same time, I think you're reading him correctly. I think he's saying, if I don't want to rent an apartment to a gay person, that should be okay. Because we don't want to force the homophobes to do something they don't want to do. But yes, when it comes to the government is not allowed to withhold my benefits or is not allowed to not give me a driver's license or remove me from my job for the federal government, et cetera, et cetera. You can't be subject to laws others aren't subject to, and you can't be excluded from benefits that others enjoy, but I think that others get to treat you differently based on your sexuality. I guess he's imagining like a landlady, a single landlady who's also homophobic, or like a mom and pop store that's also homophobic. I mean, like, what the fuck do you do with Walmart, man?
Like, but then this is like this. I don't see a limiting principle unless he thinks that gay people and the ability to discriminate against us is like should somehow be uniquely protected, as is clearly the opinion of some people on the Supreme Court. But this is an argument for resegregating lunch counters. Yeah. You know what I mean? This is like an argument for saying, okay, public accommodations are the private right of individual business owners, and therefore we must allow large amounts of discrimination in the public and commercial sphere that relegate certain classes of people to a status of lesser dignity. That is not sustainable, actually.
Yeah, I think that we can see in our own historical moment why this idea, albeit alluring, is actually pretty short-sighted. As you say, like, the private-public distinction he's operating with feels very stuck in the 1800s or something like that, because it's okay, private actors can, as you say, like, absolutely make meaningful participation in the public impossible. You know, it's not just getting the government out of that business is a very minor part of it. And of course, people use their supposed private right to infringe on other people's public rights, right? Think of 303 Creative. Think of the various Supreme Court cases that are coming out now, where it's very clear that, like, homophobic parents have a private right to determine what the public school teaches. Like, that's the obvious end game here, that people will pack into their own private seigneurial right the ability to tell other people how to live their lives, and to cast as an abrogation of that right any assertions of civil rights claims. And it's fairly obvious that this is what would happen. And that's because, not to put too fine a point on it, heterosexism has not just consisted in policing the boundary between something given that is public and something given that we call private. It has consisted in drawing the distinction between these two things in the first place, determining what is public and what is private, right? And moving the distinction this way and that, you know?
Yes, defining what is public and what you get to do in the public as a narrower and narrower slice, or as a bigger and bigger slice, depending on what the interests of heterosexism or misogyny are at the time. This is all something that he would know if he didn't hate Michel Foucault so much.
I know, right? This is like, queer theory has a whole thing on this.
It's useful. It has its moments.
Yeah, just read a goddamn book of postmodernism. Yeah, so I'm going to make a proposal. I think we were very ambitious in saying that this was going to be our episode on Andrew Sullivan. I think it is becoming fairly obvious that it is, in fact, the first part of our episode on Andrew Sullivan.
Yes. Adrian and I have this like recurring debate, which I still haven't like totally decided my position on, which is it acceptable to do a two-part episode, right? Because at a certain point, I think people stop listening. I think they're like very less likely to open up something where it's like part two. It's like, should we really discipline ourselves and just say what we have to say? But, you know, Andy, I think he just commands a lot from us. He's just such a big presence in our lives and clearly in our minds. This guy does live in our heads rent-free.
And I mean, that's what you were saying earlier with the Forrest Gump metaphor. It's not him. It's really he's pulling together historical threads that really are coming to a head and really explain a lot of our present moment. And that's not because he's like, in some cases, that's because he was perceptive and sort of noticing things. But it's also because like he acts out a bunch of the contradictions that have riven American society for the last 40 years. And I think it is worth spending more time on him. But so maybe in concluding then, we should just make three points about this book. First is the thing I said before, which is something that my colleague Paul Robinson points out in his book, Queer Wars. This book isn't written with gay people in mind. This is a book for his conservative friends, for people that he calls prohibitionists and conservatives. He wanted to figure out a version of gay rights that these people could stipulate to. And I have to say that I don't have a truck with that. I think that if you can get those freaks to accede to the version of the argument that Andrew Sullivan presents here, like, I don't agree with it, but like, that's a lot better than what we were working with. So fair play. That seems fine to me.
Did he, though? Did he get them to agree?
No, of course
or
not.
Or did he embolden a liberal legal movement that merely defeated them, albeit, I think, temporarily?
That's right. There's a very good case to be made for your skepticism. The other thing that's really interesting to me is that final point about the liberalism, right? Where he says, these are attempts to marshal the resources furnished by the Civil Rights Act of 1964 to advance gay liberation. Now, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but by 1996, those attempts were few and far between. I mean, there are some non-discrimination ordinances, but there's not a whole lot. And they're not, on the whole, particularly successful. I think this is probably not about his distaste for the Human Rights Campaign, which, as you said, like ultimately did end up following his advice. It's about his distaste for the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the kind of changes that it wrought in the field of gender and race. Does that seem right?
Well, the notion that there might be legal interventions to challenge established hierarchies really does seem contrary to Andrew Sullivan's vision of nature.
Yeah, exactly. I think he does this odd two-step where he calls the use of civil rights litigation into question with regards to a characteristic that you can hide, right? Like who you sleep with, who you're married to, who's waiting for you at home.
Some of us hide it better than others.
Right. Important and obvious point, yes. But the point being, like, the difference of race, he thinks, is much more marked. Now,
he also thinks that race makes you naturally inferior and that being gay doesn't.
Well, that's the thing. CRT would say, like, well, hang on there, Andrew.
Also, a lot of people's race is not, in fact, legible.
That's right.
In the American context, where there's kind of only two options.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, like, ask any South Asian person whether they're comfortable walking into a Home Depot right now.
Did you see that amazing Zoran Mamdani tweet that they unearthed from, like, 2014, where he's, I held the door open today for an old white man, and he turns to me, and he looks like he's got this big grin because he's so proud of himself, and he says, gracias.
Yeah, this is the thing, right?
like, this is, you know, Zoran Mamdani, famously illegible in American racial discourses. Yes.
Yeah. So that's the thing. Paul Robinson points this out in his book. He's like, this is a bizarre argument to make. Like, race is also socially constructed. It also is not obvious.
But if you believe that Charles Murray was right about there being biologically distinct races that have different average IQ scores, that's probably an argument that's going to fall on deaf ears.
Exactly. I think that's it. Like, this is an argument that presumes the facts of the bell curve to be, in fact, in evidence, right? Like, it only makes sense if you are essentially a race realist. The limits he wants to place on gay liberation then are identical with his objections to the civil rights regime post-1960s. I think that's really important that, like, this book has its, and I think our friends over at Bad Gays have made this very clear, has a very deleterious effect on the movement itself and on gay liberation as a cause. But it's important to note that it also has terrible implications for gender and racism in the United States. And then the third point I wanted to make is that there is this meliorism here that is really strange, even within its own time, right? Sullivan seems to genuinely believe that kind of this public equality, private autonomy version of gay liberation will mollify the straights, which...
Yeah, this is a common refrain in Andrew Sullivan's work in particular. One of the critiques he makes of more like radical liberation politics is not just that he finds them wrong, although he often also says that. He says they're wrong on the merits, but he'll also say that they're tactically wrong.
Yeah.
Because what they're going to do is go too far and therefore provoke a backlash that will be counterproductive to their aims, right? And he opposes their aims.
Right.
But he also says that their tactics are wrong because they won't achieve them.
That's right. Yeah, it just seems like a bizarre argument given that, like, conservatives had no trouble readjusting to the new approach that Andrew Sullivan helped pioneer. And they seem to be on the verge of overturning that too.
He's assuming that there is an ask small enough that it will not provoke backlash, that will both be like a more appropriate and right size ask because of its lack of ambition, right? Like, give us access to traditional marriage, give us access to serving in the army, right? How aggressively conservative these ambitions are, how rigorously in line with traditional American visions of honor and the good life they are. And he assumes that ostentatious cooperation with conservative values will lead to conservative acceptance. And that is not, in fact, the case, right? You cannot make an ask small enough that will get these people not to attack you, right? You have to either accept that you have enemies or capitulate.
Exactly. And part of that is just that ultimately homophobia springs from the same source as heterosexism, as misogyny, and as racism, which is an investment in hierarchies. Something, again, Sullivan would know if you read any queer theory ever. Anyway, so maybe we'll leave it there.
I'm excited to come back next time and talk about Andrew Sullivan and the Iraq War, Andrew Sullivan and the achievement of gay marriage with Obergefell, and Andrew Sullivan and the menace in his mind of trans rights and the gay rights movement's embrace of them. I think there's a lot of meat here.
And in typical In Bed with the Right fashion, we will stop with it's virtually normal. And we will not pick up with Love Undetectable, which is the follow-up essay he wrote. But we will follow up with a post on Bareback City from 1998. Oh, anyway.
God help us all. He is a fascinating figure. And hopefully, we'll all see you guys next time on your favorite podcast, In Bed with the Right.
See you next time.